Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Nicholas of Cusa, Cusaran. He's a medieval 15th century philosopher, but he's really an important transitional philosopher, transitioning from the philosophy of, you know, pure philosophy and theology, where things were sort of merged subjects. God was very much in the understanding of philosophy. It's impossible to understand philosophy or think about thinking without using God. But he got a lot of basic things about, democracy, the basic pre-ideas for democracy, the ideas which reasoned a non-Earth-centered universe, a boundless universe, and this is just through the basics of raw reasoning. So it's sort of like he was on a particular arc, and we've actually met him 5-6 centuries later in the 21st century. We've met him in this sort of complicated, more or less complicated way that we've arrived here. And in our complicated way, it seems to us straightforward, but as you look into his life and history, you go through. And again, we live in an age where we want a quick YouTube, a quick podcast, everything summarized, and I can pick everything up in 20 seconds. Well, as you come along here, it takes a little bit to understand him. So his life is one strand, his basic theory of knowledge and God is one strand, and his theory of knowledge is another strand. So we're into the fourth episode, the next strand, and we're just going to read through it. So he has basically just so many different, strange, sort of quasi-mathematical philosophy. Now, it's interesting to know that this is maths in the time before equations, and this is philosophy in the time before formal logic. So it's interesting to see how he goes here. It's not a question of actually of seeing it, but he's actually got a pretty interesting thing in terms of that you can't know anything. You can only have a metaphor for knowing, but you can actually talk about your metaphor. So this is sort of strange, but profoundly relevant in terms of if you're looking at a particular situation, you can look at the way people are solving situations. So I'm going to read this next section of this Stanford's encyclopedia called 2.2.2, Knowing and Assimilative Measuring. Isn't that great? Recall once more that Cusan's definition of the mind already alluded to the layman about the mind. Now, layman is idiota. The mind is that from which comes the limit and the measure of all things. Quote, if we set this beside the comment quoted above, that the comment quoted above that the conception in the human mind is the assimilation of beings, it's clear that assimilating and measuring are dominant metaphors Nicholas uses to understand what we do as knowers. As knowers, we measure things we know, and we also are assimilated or likened in some way to the objects of the knowledge. Now, this is really important. Like the modern scientific method is about taking a picture of a pattern, looking at the significance of that pattern. If you ask those questions, it's a lot clearer. So in a certain sense, he's a lot clearer in thinking. Along with the horizontal notion of our concepts doing images of things as well as the mind's own oneness, assimiluto is also the vertical dimension, because the knowing we liken ourselves to our divine original. So this is quite intense stuff. I really rather like it. What is at issue is the connection and the tension between the two metaphors, supposedly complementary. Assimiluto and mensura give no obvious answer to what provides the measure for content and the validity of our knowledge. Is the things known or knowing or our knowing's minds? Nicholas never questioned that the varied things we discovered in the natural universe and
Imagine ourselves in the social and cultural milieu exist independently of our minds, if not God's. But the question here is whether our knowledge is derived from the what is independent of our mind, or it is in whole part as a result of the linguistic conceptual measures we learn, construct and employ in dealing with reality. If knowing is creative or productive, solely a matter of our measuring, it's easy to see how it is an image of God's creating, but not how it is likening to an extra mental things. If thinking things outside measure and cause that we know, we can see why human knowledge is likening to things, but not how it is an image of God's creative mind. The two metaphors may well run counter to each other. So I think if you look at science, avoids this issue. Okay, because Nicholas himself does not frame the question this way, he provides ample evidence for both answers. Some of his interpreters, such as J. Hopkins, 96, says the use of medieval scholastic language for the powers and activities of the mind as placing him mainly in the medieval Aristotelian Thomist tradition of critical realism, while emphasizing a new active character of knowing at all levels and thus stressing that the mind is an active power. So it really is a transitional thing from the Aristotelian to the more modern view, and a smoother transition. Those interpreters whose proclivities are more Kantian, Immanuel Kant, for instance, K. Flash and K. Kremer, 2000, find the text gestures towards what Kant would become the transcendental unity of perception and a priori concept of understanding, not to mention the stress and active judgment. It's interesting, when you look at Kant, the people who are trying to interpret Kant began to do measurements which discovered magnetism. It's just a really interesting thing. This goes. The view of the present author is that both these interpretations may miss the Neoplatonic context in which Nicholas discusses human knowledge and may underestimate how important philosophical theology is to the Kuzian position, exposition of knowing, which is rather interesting overall because we are advanced. We at the moment are torn between these two, the Aristotelian and the Kantian view, and science is going a different direction. What are the clues we need to connect the metaphors of lightning and measuring in a complementary way? We must return to Nicholas's underlying conviction that our minds are images of God minds, and this connection between them is consistent thoroughgoing, and thus should never be overlooked. Then we may begin to understand that just as God's creative measuring sets the ontological limits of everything God creates, so our corresponding measuring can at best be assimilative of the mind, independent things which we wish to know, but do not create or place in reality, and yet be creative in measuring and adjudicating a conceptual domain that results from our knowing them. Pretty heavy going stuff. But I think he's basically, as far as I can see, is just there describing maths. Both these strands can be seen to be operative in the chapter 7 of The Layman About the Mind, or Idiota Mensa. That's my remembering of the Latin from it. Here, Cusanus, which is the Latin for Cusan, so this author calls him, when he wants to, he calls them Nicholas, Cusan and Cusanus, gives a somewhat more detailed account of how he sees the mind's cognitive function operating at levels of sensation, imagination, reasoning, and intellectual visions or intuition. Here, as in his later work entitled Compendium, we find that Nicholas inherited a technical vocabulary and conceptual framework for human knowing that embodies the medieval Aristotelian view that natural things are the causes and measures of perceptual and conceptual human knowledge. On that view, we understand it corresponds to an intelligible aspect of things that are mind independent, so that the identity and the intelligibility between the mind and things results. The mind is measured by things. While Nicholas insists that the active, self-moving mind directs and integrates a joint operation of our knowing capacity, he also agrees that the mind has no innate ideas, that the mental life has to be awakened or stimulated by direct contact with the perceptible world. He never questions that the perceptible world, the plurality of things, exists. and is independent of our minds and knowledge. So this is, I suppose, it's interesting reading all the different philosophies on it, how it goes here, and what neurology goes to describing all of this. It is the mind's power to discriminate and make sense of what we perceive, imagine, and remember that Cusanus emphasizes. He writes, speaking of imagination, quote, when sensible things are not present, it, imagination, conforms itself to things in a confused way and without discriminating one condition from another. But when functioning and thinking, imagination conforms itself to things while discriminating one thing from another. And that's from his Idiota Dementa. To help us understand, so you can imagine someone who's really themselves extremely ignorant saying, well, you know, what the heck are you doing reading something like this? Someone's writing about idiots. Okay. To help us understand the mind's engagement in perceptual assimilation, Nicholas turns to the work of sculptors and craftsmen who use wax or clay to make the impression of some shape so they can work it from that lightness, which is Platonic forms, obviously. When it is a matter of planning something to do and make, it is easy for our minds to be active. What about perceptual experiences where we encounter, where what we encounter is not up to us? Nicholas returns to the wax, asking us to imagine wax informed by the mind in a way that the mind informs our capacity for sensing, and proposing that the mind so imagined could form the wax to every shape presented to it. Nicholas is saying, in effect, that assimilation is perception, is indeed a matter of reason's active selecting and managing the deliverances of senses and imagination that result from our encounters with susceptible things. We are not a mere passive recipients of colours, sounds and textures and so on, but our minds differentiate and connect perceptions and images in order to form concepts based on discrimination and reasoning. Very interesting stuff. Nicholas avers, I've never heard seen that word, A-V-E-R-S, that our knowledge of the natural and cultural world embodied in and makes systematic in the technical and mechanical and liberal arts will remain conjectural. The reason is that we are not dealing with the true reality of mind-independent things. Those true forms are one with God. We only encounter the physically located temporal realities that are images of the really real, the really real. As he remarks, the, quote, the notions that are attained through the assimilation of reason are uncertainty because they are in accord with images of forms rather than of their true forms, and close quote. Okay, now that's really interesting there, because he is Neoplatonic, and he is actually dealing with the idea of forms, which is interesting with artificial intelligence. Only the concepts of mathematics are not conjectural because we fashion or construct these ideas ourselves. Consequently, our conceptions of them can be precise and certain. Or as conceptual entities, they escape the source of challenges and bodily limits, characteristics of the physical world. We're going to finish this podcast here, but certainly, surely this person is really, by not letting us proceed too deeply into our modern thinking, really asking the fundamental questions. You know, why is maths is absolute for these reasons, whereas the physical sciences, which uses maths, involves measurements, and measurements must have four quantities with them. The size, the uncertainty, the units, and there's probably a fourth quantity here, which I've forgotten. So that's my brain not working properly. I'll go away and think about that. Thanks for listening. Next episode will be the measure of knowledge, which we will get into. But as you can see, there is no shortcut to understanding. Yes, these people have done a lot of work, and a lot of their work is not really relevant today, but it's equally not okay to just say, look, I suppose it is relevant if people dismiss this out of hand. Thanks for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.